wonderful presentations by the participants, to hear from the Av Beit Din, the head of the Jewish court of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, Rabbi Yonah Ries. Those who remember the last time that we studied forensic science, we asked the former Av Beit Din, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz Shlita, to speak for the Jewish Jerusalem Science Contest, and he did. I approached him again, this time, and he said to me, if you really want to have somebody speak in front of me who was involved in halacha and forensic science, talk to Rabbi Ries. Because after the very unfortunate tragic events of the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center, there were many halakhic issues that arose concerning spouses that may or may not have been present in the attack towers, leaving their wives and their husbands at home wondering where they were, and after lack of communication, can we remarry and get on with our life? So Rabbi Yonah Ries is the Av Beit Din of Chicago Rabbinical Council. He is a noted Torah scholar, attorney, and jurist. Rabbi Ries continues to serve as Rosh Yeshiva at Ritz, and he is a summa cum laude graduate of Yeshiva University and went on to receive his law degree from Yale Law School, where he was senior editor of the Law Journal. He received his rabbinic ordination from Ritz, where he has also earned the distinction of Yadin Yadin. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Rabbi Yonah Ries. We I pass the moderator. Here, you want? Here it is.
Post it on the screen. If
I could actually do that.
All right. Well, good evening. It's really a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Rabbi Weiner, Dr. Walder, Dr. Friedman, all of the judges, all of the participants, all of the contestants. I really enjoyed listening to all of the presentations from the students. I thought they were all excellent and very worthwhile. I wanted to talk about my own involvement in forensic science. The only caveat is that as I was involved in making forensic science determinations, I don't think that I realized that this is what I was doing. When I served as the director of the Beth Din of America in New York, and I was working at that time closely with Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who not only served as the Av Beit Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, but also serves as the Av Beit Din, the Chief Rabbinical Judge of the Beit Din of America in New York, we had to deal with the unfortunate tragedy of the attack by terrorists upon the World Trade Center. And in the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy, where there were close to 3,000 individuals who were murdered, there were individuals who were missing who were married men from the Jewish community. And according to Jewish law, whenever there is a missing husband and the remains cannot be easily found, it requires a Jewish law determination that the individual can be proven to be dead, so that the wife, the widow, will be permitted to remarry, and otherwise she's considered to be an aguna. And this is considered to be a very serious determination from the perspective of Jewish law, because if it turns out that a rabbinical court makes a mistake in terms of this determination, then if the woman remarries, she might be committing adultery, and any child who would be born of that second marriage would be considered to be illegitimate according to Jewish law and wouldn't be allowed to marry freely within the Jewish community. So what happened in the aftermath of the tragedy was that after being shell-shocked like everybody else for a couple of days, the Betin realized that we were going to be called upon to assist in these types of determinations, which was something that we weren't really accustomed to doing. So we had to start doing assiduous research into Jewish law texts and volumes to determine how this research is conducted and how we go about compiling all of the information in a responsible fashion in order to make the appropriate Jewish law determinations. So the first step was that we needed to notify the community of our availability to be able to assist in these determinations for families who tragically suffered the loss. And approximately 1 week after the terrible tragedy, we issued a joint letter together with the Orthodox Union, with the Rabbinical Council of America, to all of the member rabbis of these organizations, indicating that if there were individuals from their communities who were affected by these attacks, communities, families who were torn asunder because members of the community, of the husbands from the family, had been presumed to be murdered in these attacks, then we would be available to assist in the Jewish law determinations. And over the next several weeks after the tragedy, we received many calls from various rabbis, including rabbis of Orthodox synagogues, rabbis of non-Orthodox synagogues. Everybody ended up coming to us because of our reputation as a rabbinical court competent to deal with issues of Jewish law and sensitive in terms of serving the broader Jewish community. And it was overwhelming how many calls and inquiries we received, both from rabbis and also from individuals and families who had suffered loss in connection with the World Trade Center. We received inquiries from the Chabad community to assist them as well, and also from a Hillel director of a university who knew of a family from the place where he worked that had suffered a loss in the tragedy. We then, after we identified these families and facilitators of individuals who had suffered loss, who had lost spouses and so forth, we sent out a letter requesting information. You have copies of the letter that we sent out. You can see it's dated October 11, 2001. And I guess what we were doing was essentially asking the parties to help us gather forensic evidence. We met with an Israeli expert who had been involved in investigations following terrorist attacks in Israel, where body remains needed to be identified, where similar inquiries needed to be conducted. And we met with this expert in the offices of the Jewish Community Relations Council in New York with a number of other representatives of the Jewish community. His name was Dr. J. Levinson. And Dr. Levinson told us that he would be willing to be of assistance in facilitating these investigations. We communicated with him frequently over the course of the next several months. But he also told us that we should contact the families and make sure that they had submitted DNA samples from the missing husbands that could be collected from their toothbrushes, from their combs, from their shavers, in case there would be body parts that would be discovered from the rubble of the World Trade Center that could be compared with the DNA samples, and that could assist us in making determinations, even from the standpoint of Jewish law, because there were Jewish law authorities who were consulted about this question. It was felt that, although as has been pointed out, DNA is not actively researched in order to be able to convict somebody of a crime necessarily, if DNA can be used for a helpful purpose in order to free an aguna, free a woman whose status is unclear, in order to confirm the death of her husband, then it would be appropriate to take advantage of modern-day DNA technology. So among the questions we asked was, please make sure not to throw away hairbrushes, toothbrushes, shavers, etc. that may contain DNA evidence. We also asked for the people to prepare any kind of other evidence that would pinpoint the individuals who have been in the building at the time of the attack, and also to share any eyewitness accounts that they knew of that we could further research in order to be able to verify that the husbands were in the building, as well as Easy Pass and MetroCard records that would be able to confirm that the men were on their way to work that day, if we needed to find circumstantial evidence that would place them at the scene of the World Trade Center in order to confirm that they were likely killed in the attack upon the World Trade Center. We then asked the various widows to sign authorization forms that would authorize the Beth Din to speak and communicate with different city agencies and with other and with the firms where the husbands worked and with co-workers and so forth, so that if we would reach out to somebody, they would know that we were legitimate and that we had been authorized to speak to them and to elicit information by the family. And all of these widows, we had 10 cases that were officially and formally submitted to us. There were 15 cases in all that we were involved in, either directly or in a consultative capacity based on other rabbinical courts working on those cases and consulting with us. And in these 10 cases, we actually received written authorizations from the widows for us to deal with these cases. I have to tell you, it's very interesting that although we received these written authorizations, by and large, we never needed to use them, because whenever we contacted a city agency or the medical examiner's office or a co-worker, people just trusted us, because that was the atmosphere in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 tragedy. Tragically brought people together, that everyone kind of felt that we were all in this together, and there was a much more of a sense of trust that everybody had for each other. It dissipated quickly, but at least for several weeks to a month or so after the tragedy, there was a tremendous sense of trust, and we went very quickly to everybody to gather information, which was a good thing, because for the first month, everybody spoke to us, and we gathered an immense amount of information. In fact, we gathered so much information after the World Trade Center tragedy that at one point when we saw that there had been an extensive article about the timeline of the tragedy and everything that happened from the newspaper publication USA Today, we met with the authors of that article from USA Today, and when they met with us, they looked at all the evidence that we had compiled from the cases we were dealing with, and they said, wow, you have much more stuff than we do. We had, because of our halachic Jewish law responsibility to compile information, we had done pretty much as thorough or more thorough a job than any other group, any other investigative body, any other reporters in compiling all of the information relating to the tragedy. Then, as a Jewish law protocol, we had to have what's known as a Kabbalas Edus, an actual acceptance of testimony, where three representatives of the rabbinical court met with each of the widows and whatever witnesses that they brought to the meeting in order to gather the testimony. So of the victims whom we investigated, four of them worked in the North Tower, which was the first tower that was hit approximately at the 93rd floor or so. It was hit in such a way that severed the top of the building from the bottom of the building, so anybody who was above the point of impact had absolutely no way of escaping or descending to the bottom of the building other than jumping or falling to a certain death. We had five individuals who had worked in the South Tower, of the World Trade Center, and where the building was hit approximately 15 minutes later, but it collapsed a half hour earlier than the first building. And there, the building was hit in kind of a zigzag fashion on the 78th floor, and there was still one stairwell that remained passable, so a mere showing of the fact that the person was in the building in a place which was above the points of impact would not have been sufficient evidence from the standpoint of Jewish law by itself to conclude that the person had immediately died. And we had to gather all of this information. We also had one individual who was on the American Airlines flight that crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. So, for example, when we met with that widow, we received from the widow the boarding pass information that she had gotten from the airline that the husband had in fact aborted the plane, and we were then able to follow up with the airline to confirm that anybody who was issued the boarding pass in fact would have remained on the plane, and they would have had a record if the person would have gotten off at the last minute or so we could utilize that as information as well. Jewish law also requires investigation of such facts as whether the husband and wife were living together in harmony, because according to the Talmud, if a husband disappears and the couple had not been living together in marital harmony, then a person might conceivably take advantage of a tragedy in order to escape from their unhappy marriage. So part of the conversation we had was also speaking, obviously in a diplomatic fashion, about the marriage itself. And all of these conversations took place when we met with these individuals. Then we had follow-up conversations and investigation afterwards with the firms, with the co-workers. We received from one law firm in the South Tower a detailed report that they had prepared about how the missing husband in question was an individual who was involved with saving all of the other people who worked in his firm. They hired an investigative firm to do a detailed report of what happened, and a number of the people of the firm who testified said, oh, there was this one individual, he happened to be one of the missing husbands, who refused to leave the building, even though everybody knew that it was in danger, and this was after the time that the North Tower had been hit, and the South Tower had not yet been hit, and they were in the process of evacuating right before the South Tower was hit. And the report stated that this person refused to go down until every single member of the firm had gone down first, and there was one person who was resisting the order to leave, and he went back upstairs to get that person, and after he went back upstairs to get that person, that's when the building was hit. So we were able to compile all of this information. There was another man who worked at the Department of Taxation and Finance on the South Tower on the 86th floor who was missing, and we found eyewitnesses whom we spoke with who told us that they saw this man right outside the elevator of the 78th floor, which was the express elevator bank. In the World Trade Center, the way it worked was that you would go from the first floor up to the 78th floor, which was the express elevator, and if you worked above the 78th floor in either of the buildings, you would take local elevators to your particular firm. This woman who went into the last elevator that went down the South Tower before it was struck said she saw this man standing outside of the elevator talking to a Port Authority officer, and the Port Authority officer was telling this man that he should go back to his office because it was probably safer to stay in the building than to go outside. Of course, nobody can be criticized for the split-second judgments that were made during a time of crisis, but this decision obviously turned out to be tragic for that individual. Afterwards, we also had to coordinate with the medical examiner's office, because not only did we need to compile the circumstantial evidence, we also needed to find out if there was any kind of medical evidence that remains had been discovered of the individuals. As I mentioned, most of the remains that were found were not viable remains of an entire body, but were fragments of a person's body. And in general, it's very difficult to make identifications on that basis. But there was one case where there was enough of a skull that was discovered at the site of the rubble that they were able to make a determination of the dental records of the individual. And then a comparison was made with the dental records of a particular missing person who was one of the missing husbands, and the dental records matched. And we were given access to all of the records by the medical examiner's office. Every single day when they made identifications, they sent faxes to our office. We were on the fax notification list of any identifications they made any given day. I don't know those of you who remember, there used to be something known as fax machines, and they sent, you know, faxes and stuff like that in the olden days. And we would contact them and be given access to all of the records to see just exactly how thoroughly they made these identifications. And according to Jewish law, if you have any type of an identification mark which has a high level of reliability that less than 1 in 1,000 people would share that characteristic, that's called a siman mufak. It's called an ironclad type of identification that can be relied upon for identification of remains in this type of situation. And these types of identifying marks, such as dental x-rays, are considered to be reliable by the halakhic authorities. Rav Avadya Yosef, who just recently passed away, an eminent halakhic authority of our generation, ruled that dental x-rays could be relied upon. We had another case where a pair of pants was found. The body parts inside the pair of pants could not be identified by DNA analysis. However, there were actual objects inside of the person's pants. And inside the pants were found the individual's wallet with his driver's license and with numerous credit cards, as well as the person's keys to his house. And there's a Jewish law principle that if you have kelim d'lo mushli inshi, you have the type of utensils that a person doesn't normally loan out to other individuals, then you can assume that if it's found together with an unidentified body, that that unidentified body belongs to the individual to whom these items pertain. And in this particular case, we had a combination of testimony that the person was in the building, that we had collected from someone who had a conversation with a co-worker right after the North Tower was hit, and this person worked in the South Tower, and this co-worker had said to her mother that, oh, I'm sitting next to so-and-so. So we knew that he had been in at his desk right before the South Tower was hit, and we also had the combination of that information together with the remains of the body parts of the pants that also had his identification in them. And according to Jewish law, when you have that combination of evidence, that can be relied upon, even if you would otherwise be worried that maybe the person in some rare occurrence happened to lend out his wallet or his keys. So therefore, that was also something that we were able to collect and we were able to rely upon based on our coordination with the medical examiner's office. Now, there were other cases where we had a combination of speaking to eyewitnesses, whether it was the wife or whether it was a friend of an individual, who were able to identify that the person was in their office at the time of the attack. And if the person was in the North Tower, that information, together with the knowledge that nobody could have escaped from above the point of impact of the North Tower, was also sufficient evidence from the standpoint of Jewish law that the person had perished. That's what we call, according to Jewish law, according to the Talmud, the case of Nafal L'Kivshon Ha'esh. A person falls into a fiery furnace, a deep fiery furnace from which he's not able to escape. As long as you have eyewitnesses or other reliable testimony that the person went into the fiery furnace, that's sufficient evidence in order to permit the widow to remarry. Now, while we had this information in certain cases, there was one case where there was nobody who had spoken on the phone or engaged in an email conversation who was available, who was able to identify that a certain individual was in his office at all that day. Now, we know he left for work that day, but is that something that you could rely upon according to Jewish law? Most of the Jewish law sources talk about you see somebody sink into an ocean where you watch and you see they didn't emerge from the ocean, and there are clear boundaries, so you know that the person is dead, or they fell inside of a fiery furnace, so you know that the person is dead. But what if you didn't see the person at the site of the catastrophe altogether? You just know that he was on his way to work. So that's why we asked for, in item number 6, MetroCard records, for example, to try to establish some sort of a pattern, because there are Jewish law authorities who have written responsa saying that if you know that a person was on his way somewhere, like to a bridge that collapsed or to a train station, a bus station that was bombed and the person didn't return and there were unidentified remains, then you can assume that among the unidentified remains include this individual as well. So therefore, we had to investigate this particular case. If the person would have been in his office was above the point of impact in the North Tower, and that's something we could have relied upon. So the first thing we asked was, are there swipe records that a person had to utilize in order to get into the World Trade Center building? Most buildings don't have this, but believe it or not, in the World Trade Center, if you work there, the only way you are able to get in the morning would be if you use a swipe card to get into the building. So you figure that would be a great way of identifying who arrived at the building that day on 9/11. Except that when the buildings collapsed, all of the records were destroyed as well, and they hadn't yet done backup for the month of September. They had done backup for the month of August. So we had this fellow swipe records for the month of August, but that didn't necessarily help us for September 11th, except it did. Because we found out from the widow that this person in question normally took the subway to work, and he used his Metro card in order to get onto the subway. Okay, how does that help us? Well, this fellow was very meticulous about keeping records. That's how he was able to work for a prestigious firm in the World Trade Center. And he kept records of his Metro cards. He purchased them with his credit card so he could keep a record of every single purchase. So the widow provided for us the credit card statement. From the credit card statement, we were able to determine his MetroCard purchase. We then turned to the Manhattan Transit Authority, and the Manhattan Transit Authority provided us with a record of his MetroCard usage every single day, so we were able to verify that he used his MetroCard in the normal fashion on September 11th, that he used his MetroCard, in fact, every single working day during September, and we also had the MetroCards for the month of August. Well, we received the MetroCard records from the Manhattan Transit Authority. We received the swipe card records from the World Trade Center from the Port Authority of New York, which owned the World Trade Center. And we were able to establish an algebraic pattern of when he used his MetroCard at the subway turnstile every day during the month of August and when he entered afterwards into the World Trade Center. And on that basis, we were able to make a calculation based on when he used his Metro card on September 11th, when he could have been expected to have arrived at the World Trade Center on September 11th, and when would be, based on the prior records, even the latest time that he would have arrived at the World Trade Center on September 11th. And we also received records from the Manhattan Transit Authority of exactly when the trains arrived that day, so we could see when the earliest train was that arrived at his subway station after he had turned his MetroCard into the turnstile, so we knew approximately when he was able to board the subway train. And on that basis, and also interviewing people who worked at the World Trade Center on how long it took to travel from the first floor of the World Trade Center to the floor where this fellow worked, we were able to place him. I mean, this is a tragic determination, but it was for a positive purpose going forward, obviously. We were able to place him at his desk no later than approximately 2 or 3 minutes before the North Tower was tragically struck. And on this basis, we're able to utilize that information for Jewish law purposes in order to arrive at an identification that he had, that he could be declared dead for Jewish law purposes, and his wife would be permitted to remarry. We also had an extensive meeting in a synagogue that was located almost across the street from the medical examiner's office to determine our own assessment of the viability of DNA evidence for purposes of making these identifications. We met with DNA experts in the medical examiner's office. We were in touch with the chief examiner of the medical examiner's office. We met with representatives of other rabbinical courts, and we were able to conduct a careful investigation from the perspective of Jewish law of what DNA analysis was all about and whether we felt that it was acceptable from the standpoint of Jewish law. And the issues were, number one, it's not visible to the human eye, and identifications mentioned in the Talmud are visible to the human eye, and number two, that the way that DNA is used to identify fragments of bones or tissue through the DNA coding in every single cell is through looking at a combination of the DNA coding in 13 different loci, and you have to combine all of the different codes together. So there was a question, is this considered an ironclad type of identification, or is this considered to be like a moderate identification that just when you put all of the different parts together, it becomes ironclad, and is that really considered to be ironclad? So without going into all the details of the analysis, we came to the conclusion in consultation with other leading Jewish law authorities that the same way that Jewish law allows you to look at an individual without seizing upon a particular physical characteristic, but just look at them and say, I know it's this person because I just recognize that this person looks different from everybody else, the same way you can make the same identification of DNA, even though you're not able to point to a certain shape of a nose or a certain type of a wart on the person's body, but you just know scientifically that nobody else shares exactly the same DNA. DNA is often reliable with a margin of error of less than 1 in 1 million or 1 in 1 billion, or in certain cases, less than 1 in 1 quintillion. So that was also something that we were able to utilize. Based on all of these different methods of investigation and cooperation with the different authorities and collection of very significant circumstantial evidence, we were eventually able to resolve every single case that was brought to us. But we did it through a meticulous Jewish law process. After I compiled all of the data, I then had to go through another recitation of testimony of everything that I had gathered and meet in front of another rabbinical court that we had assembled of the leading judges of the Beth Din and go over all of the testimony in front of them, including Rav Herschel Schechter and Rabbi Mordechai Willig, so that there would be an official acceptance of all of the testimony and evidence that we had compiled for Jewish law purposes, after which there were responsa, there were Jewish law tshuvot, decisions that were written, as is customary according to our tradition. And since these types of determinations have such far-ranging impact in terms of the ability of the women to marry and the future legitimacy of their children, we follow the time-honored custom of sharing these responsa, these written decisions, with leading authorities all over the world, including Rav Avadi Yosef, including Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, including Rav Nutzer Greenblatt from Tennessee, other leading authorities, so that we would receive a consensus of agreements among all of the authorities that our determinations could be relied upon. But one thing that was important for us to bear in mind during this entire process is that we were dealing with real people who suffered devastating loss, who are in incredibly fragile positions in their lives, and the main part of our involvement with helping them through the processes of Jewish law, but with a great degree of sensitivity. So we were very, very careful to constantly consult with them at every stage of the process, and to make sure that whatever pastoral needs they had were satisfied as well, including when to commence the process of mourning. Technically speaking, some authorities say that you can't really commence the process until the Beis Din has made a determination. But in those cases where it was necessary to be lenient, we relied on those authorities who said as long as there is a Beis Din process in place that's going through the investigation, if a widow needs to begin the healing process through sitting Shiva, then that can be allowed, and we did that in one case. There were a couple of cases where the husbands died before they had a chance to have any children. I have to tell you, there were four cases in which the couple had their only child either right before 9/11 or in the months following 9/11. And you can imagine what that must have been like, and particularly for the women who are still pregnant, where the couple's only child after their husband had tragically been killed in the World Trade Center attack. But in those two cases where there were no children, the husbands left brothers, and we had to perform a chalitza ceremony, which is a ceremony under Jewish law. If a man leaves no children and he leaves a brother, then the widow is supposed to marry the brother. That's called yibum. We don't do that in the Ashkenazi community. But then the only way she's allowed to marry somebody else is if the brother performs a chalitza ceremony, which involves a ceremonial removal of a specially manufactured shoe from the brother's foot by the widow. And we did two such chalitza ceremonies. And then, 10 years later, after we had resolved all of these cases of the World Trade Center tragedy, I was invited one night when we were living in Riverdale, New York, to a Sheva Brachos. And I didn't know the chassan, but the groom, but I was invited because we knew the bride's family. And then when I got there, the groom came over to me, and he introduced himself, and he said, you know, we've met before. And I said, I don't remember exactly. Maybe you can remind me where we've met. And he told me that 10 years earlier, he had been the teenage brother of one of the victims in the World Trade Center attack. And he actually came to our Beis Din to perform the chalitza for his sister-in-law. And now, 10 years later, just divine providence would have it that I was invited to a Sheva Brachos after he himself got married. And I got up at the Sheva Brachos and I said, it just so happens, although nobody who invited me knows this, that I actually have familiarity with the chassan, and I can attest to his high level of integrity and good character, and I left it at that. So I'm reminded as we approach the upcoming parashios of the Parsha Shmini, when Aaron HaKohen suffered a terrible loss when his sons, during one of the happiest occasions of his life, the consecration of the tabernacle, were tragically taken away from him. And the Torah says, Vayidom Aharon. Aharon was completely silent. However, if you look at the continuation of the verses, it seems he wasn't 100% completely silent, because he was told that he should eat from the sacrifices that were offered that day, and suddenly Aaron actually chirps up, and he says, "Batikreno sika ela," that after such immense tragedy, "V'achalti chatas hayom," if I'm going to eat from all of the sacrifices, "Hayitav b'nei Hashem," is this going to really be pleasing in the eyes of Hashem? And Moshe Rabbeinu, his brother, realizes that Aaron is correct and that he's not really supposed to eat from all of the sacrifices. But how is it that Aaron spoke at all if the Torah says he was silent? So the answer, I think, is that the silence in the face of tragedy in terms of providing for explanations or philosophical reasoning, for what the Torah tells us is that there is a process for going forward, for figuring out what do you do after the tragedy occurs. What's the framework for plotting out the future? And one of the fathers of the widows on the 10th anniversary of the World Trade Center came over to me. He was somebody I saw around. We didn't speak regularly. And he said, you know, I've been meaning to say this to you just for a long time. I didn't never really find the right opportunity. He said, thank you. And the reason why I want to thank you is, not because we had any doubt that, you know, our son-in-law had perished, but because you provided, according to Jewish law, a framework for dealing with the situation. You provided for a halakhic process that was therapeutic and that enabled us to heal. And this is what the forensic process, at least according to Jewish law, was able to accomplish in the aftermath of the World Trade Center. I hope that in the future, these types of discussions will be purely theoretical in nature, and that we'll only utilize forensic science for happy things and happy occasions, such as the Jerusalem Science Contest. So thank you very much.